They're back. The Star Trek gang returns to fight the Klingons and a Vulcan half-brother of Mr. Spock in Star Trek V, The Final Frontier. It's one of five new films we'll be reviewing this week on Siskel and Ebert. I'm Gene Siskel of the Chicago Tribune.
And I'm Roger Ebert of the Chicago Sun-Times. Our first movie is the fifth in the Star Trek series, and I'm afraid I'm going to have to say that it's the worst.
Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert, two titans of cinematic review. Sometimes right, sometimes wrong, but always captivating. Your hosts Antonio of the Cult Worthy Cinema Podcast and Justin Henson of the Movie Wire are here to take you back to the balcony. Okay, so right off the bat, we can tell that Gene's not a fan of Star Trek V, The Final Frontier, which is the show that we are doing this week, the movie we are talking about. But what's different than previous weeks is we have a guest. And I feel this is our new thing, is every time we do a Star Trek movie, we have to bring a guest on. So when we did Star Trek The Motion Picture, we brought our friend Josh Scar of the Talking Smack podcast. So for Star Trek V, The Final Frontier, welcome, my friend, John Madsen of the Yours, Mine, and Their podcast, a semi-local podcast here to Utah, who I've been on their show, they've been on mine. But John, you have a very special prerequisite for being a guest on the show. So as you introduce yourself, how about you explain what that is?
I ran one of my first podcasts that I ran is a podcast called JR Watches Star Trek for the First Time, which is a podcast that I do with my buddy Roy, who goes by Roy now instead of JR. It's very confusing. We have to have a whole history lesson with it. But the deal is, this was like 15 years ago I started this podcast. So this is back when, you know, we had a lot of listeners. It was really great. And it was a really winning podcast. It did really well. But the concept is, I was the nerd growing up liking Star Trek. My friend was always made fun of me for watching Star Trek and called me a nerd and beat me up and stuff like that. But one day he's like, okay, you know what? If I want my kids to eat the food that I prepare for them and they don't want to try it because they never had it, he realized immediately, John, I have to watch every episode of Star Trek. So that's why we made it a podcast. So we did the podcast for 15 years until we had to do all the new Star Trek. And now, we got really sick of Star Trek and we kind of don't do the podcast anymore. But you can find the old episodes. It's great.
I mean, 15 years ago would put you in like the infancy of not only Star Trek podcasting, but just podcasting in general.
Yeah. There were only 1,000 podcasts back then or whatever. I don't know.
Right.
It was an early time. It was a really early time. It was fun, rowdy, Wild West days.
And I don't know any of your opinions of the movies, because we talk about movies all the time, but we've never talked about Star Trek movies. So this is exciting. Yeah. Now, Justin Henson, my co-host, again, same thing. You and I have talked about Star Trek movies, but I have no clue if you're actually into the Star Trek world. Are you a Trekkie? Like, do you watch the shows, or are you like me, movies and a few of the hit episodes only?
Well, it's funny because I started with the movies, and the movies just spiked my curiosity of going back and watching the show. And I did get into The Next Generation for a while, and I'll from time to time just pop it on, and it's almost like a relaxation piece for me because it's cheesy, it's fun, it's curious, but I'm a fan of the holistic film series. And we're going to get into it, but this one was Undiscovered Country was my first introduction to Star Trek. And this one coming out prior, I'll have an opinion on it, but I'm not a hardcore Star Trek fan.
I think the biggest thing for me is that, like, I'm a huge OG series fan. I like Next Generation. I like the Next Generation movies fine, but I could sit and watch Star Trek, the motion picture, all the way through Undiscovered Country and be equally entertained by all of them. Are they all equally good quality-wise? Absolutely not, as we'll probably discuss in this episode. But I think that they do a good job at linking you from one film to the next. even if they have like different approaches to the storytelling, like one might be the action one, one might be the sentimental one, one might be the eco-friendly one, you still feel like you're in the Star Trek universe and they keep it consistent, even with the missteps. So that being said, my brief history. First one I saw in the theater was Search for Spock at a drive-in when I was like 3. First one I really remember was Voyage Home, Final Frontier seeing it with my parents, and then 6, Undiscovered Country, which is my personal favorite of the OG movies. I think that 5 as a child really was cool and I liked it. But as an adult, after studying theology and after seeing a lot of other Star Trek episodes, I have different thoughts. Not necessarily bad ones, but different ones. So I say we go one by one before we get into the actual criticism and review of the movie. Where does Star Trek V, The Final Frontier, sit in your ranking of 1 through 6? I'll go first. It's number 4 for me.
I'm gonna go 3, which is weird. But it's my 3. There's no reason why anybody wouldn't say, okay, 5 is number 6. I get that. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to go 3 just because it's the enjoyment of the hate watch. But I'll get into that later.
Oh, and you are definitely by far like the contrarian of your podcast, where you will promote things that most other people hate just to say, well, I like it and you're wrong.
yeah. Well, no, I wouldn't call myself a contrarian. No, you're wrong. You're wrong about that.
You're not doing it right
now.
Let's go on. Justin, how about you? Where does it land on your list?
Well, I'm going to be that guy. I'm going to say it's at the very bottom. It's going to be number 6. It's like the Star Trek Insurrection of the Next Gen films, where it feels good. It has a lot of good ideas. It kind of just coasts, but even though it's at the bottom, I want to just clarify, it doesn't mean that I hated it. It's just I liked everything else a lot more.
Well, and you can eat me because you're putting Insurrection below Nemesis.
That was what I was going to bring up. Okay, Justin, I just said I don't fault anybody for saying this is the worst of the original cast, but Insurrection is my personal favorite of the Next Gen.
Well, I'll get into it because they both have almost similar kind of almost laid back tones to it. They have big ideas. They have underlying messaging, but there's not a lot of big stakes to it that both those films prove. So they just kind of just go with it, where you just have these feelings on screen, but you don't really get anything by the end of it.
I will give you this much, that Insurrection definitely is the lazier of the movies with what it's trying to do, where the idea is bigger than its execution. I kind of agree with that. But with my defense of 5, for one, the fact that this is an ego project is one of my favorite parts about this movie. The fact that you've got in his late 40s, early 50s, Shatner, the suspension of disbelief that this dude is free-scaling El Capitan, and the silhouette that they show of him is like a svelte, slender man, and then they cut to the shot of him on the side of the actual plaster cliff, and it's Shatner, you're already bought into it. Like, okay, this is a vanity project 100%. And from that moment on, I'm along for the Shatner ride. And that's what I like about the movie, is that no one else in this cast could try and direct a movie and put themselves as the front and center of it. And he does it. And it's exactly why I like the movie, is because it feels like a big toupee on an aging body, but it's one that you want to see.
And I think that's where it's your level of love of Shatner. And I do love Shatner. I love his confidence. But at the same time, this one has those big ideas of chemistry. One of those Star Trek movies that's in between some bigger ideas of the action, of more stakes, where you have almost an opportunity of chemistry build. And we see that set up right from the first opening scene of the first act, I should say, of building these three characters to really learn something. And then it comes into Shatner just bulldozing his screen time here and almost ruins that, again, one of those bigger ideas of what this movie could have been. After watching it the third time this week, it almost made me a little pissed off because I really wanted more of these characters. I wanted more row, row, row your boat action coming from these characters versus just the Shatner show. And that's where I think this was a misstep in the production of really giving him kind of that creative control, because there is a lot more we can see at the surface level here of what it could have been. And it does dive into religion. It dives into the other characters' backstories a little bit. And then we just pull away. It just almost dips our toes into that water. And then we get nothing because we have to go back to that Shatner show. Again, I respect Shatner for what he's trying to do. But at the same time, this is where we are left with really nothing of what it could have been.
Before I pass it on to Madsen, what I do love about this particular entry in the series is one of the things that we talked about in the motion picture episode that we did is my biggest complaint was they took our three favorite characters and they put them in different rooms and kept them apart the entire time. Like Shatner's doing his thing and McCoy's doing his thing and Spock's floating around in the V'ger purgatory, essentially. And the thing I complained about is like, my three favorite people are not spending any time together, and leave it to Shatner to bring our three characters and put them together throughout almost the entire movie. And I think that's what wins me over is like, yes, finally, a Star Trek entry where each and every one of my favorite people are in the same room together for almost the entire film. No other Star Trek film in the OG series does that. And so I have to give him a wink and a nod that he did do that. Madsen, your turn.
That's a good, I just want to, before I go, I want to agree with you because I didn't really consider that. And I think that's one reason why I do like this movie is I don't think you guys mentioned what you think of the original series from the 60s. Kind of like you guys, I started with the movies. That was my entry point, and I went backward all the way back to the original series. And that kind of became my favorite Star Trek thing, specifically the triumvirate, right?
Mm-hmm.
Spock, Kirk, McCoy, the way they interact with each other, the way that they're three sides of the coin, you know, maybe something closer to like ego, super ego, id kind of relationships among each other, how they bounce off of each other. And so we do have that in this one. Let me just say something that doesn't work. I was watching the movie today, and I think I realized the point that kind of puts me on the wrong track with this one. And we all like Star Trek IV, the one with the whales, of course. I think there's some residual energy from Star Trek IV because they did something really, really silly with Star Trek IV. It's amazing it worked. They're like, okay, let's not go to space. Let's make a sitcom in 20th century San Francisco, America, of a bunch of people fish out of water, and they're going to act really weird and silly, and there's going to be jokes flying around them, and it's going to be kind of a little bit of a goof fest, and it kind of works with Star Trek IV. A lot of people who watch Star Trek IV now kind of like it the least because that doesn't work today.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of worked back then, and, you know, senses of humor change, opinions change. I think, you know, a lot of new people coming into Star Trek, I've noticed that, which is kind of surprising because it's sort of a beloved one. That residual humorous energy folds into this movie where, you know, I think the row, row, row your boat kind of stuff, that kind of works. But elements of, you know, Chekhov and Sulu lusting after the Klingon warrior woman, and Scotty hitting his head on the hull of the Enterprise, and many other little kind of groan inducing, the fan dance, a lot of the stuff that's supposed to be light, it kind of infantilizes these beloved characters. Mm. It takes them down. And so we're already kind of thinking, it's like, okay, is this a kid show? And it's gonna tackle these big questions about what is God? Does God exist? What is faith? You know, the deception of religion in a certain sense. And that's how the movie gets off on the wrong foot. I will say something. This might sound a little bit weird, but this movie, I like it a lot because it culturally fits. It's in its place, and that place is, I think, our collective Schadenfreude of seeing Shatner fail at something. and it's kind of like, you know, when I think of Star Trek V, I think of the line in Fight Club, you know, who are you going to fight? And Edward Norton says, Shatner. I'll fight William Shatner. I'm like, yeah, there's some real truth to that statement. There's something about the character of William Shatner and his place in culture, and his time comes along. Nimoy directed the two before this, and now it's Shatner's turn, and it's just so fitting, and it feels so strangely good in this kind of really weird, sadistic way to be like, to watch this movie and make fun of it. And like watching it kind of, I wouldn't say it's a hate watch. I would say it's more enjoyable to just watch and let the time pass and let Shatner do his thing and just kind of laugh at a little bit, but kind of beside, because Shatner's been my friend for 40 years, you know?
Right.
Just to kind of let that flow and experience it in that kind of weird vibe. And that's, again, why I say it's like, okay, this isn't a good movie, but it has something, it has that entertainment value that, for example, the motion picture just didn't have. You're just like, am I allowed to dislike the motion picture? It's so serious and so earnest and it looks so good, but like, it's not as fun to dislike the motion picture as it is this one.
I agree. So it's not like it's Tommy Wiseau's Star Trek V, but it's triggering the same gland in your brain that allows you to enjoy Tommy Wiseau's Star Trek V.
Well, I think that was summed up brilliantly, because I think that is absolutely spot on, because there is no hate for this movie, even though it's at the bottom of my list. But I think you're right. We just kind of coast along it, and there are elements that do work. And nobody's going to fault this movie, especially with Shatner, on calling it ambitious, because it is an ambitious movie. Whenever you try and tackle the religious aspect of sci-fi and trying to integrate that, it's going to either piss off a lot of sci-fi fans or you're going to cheer. This one doesn't do either. It just kind of goes in between the lines of it. And, you know, even up when we get to the climax where we have almost a Ghostbusters rooftop scene that tries to tackle the aspect of religion, it's quick. There's no substance to it and it's not earned. But you know what? It's a feast for the eyes, and we have our characters going up against this godlike creature that we still don't know who the hell this person is. So,
right. <don't. laughs>
But you know what? It's entertaining. And I think that's where this one really caught my attention, is the ambition of it. Was it well executed to me? No, it wasn't, because it had all these ideas floating around to it, but at no point was I never not entertained by it, whether that was by poor filmmaking or direction. And that's the biggest problem I think we have here, is with Shatner's direction. But the characters are what support this movie along for the ride. And those that are Star Trek fans will go along for this ride. And I'm not a hardcore original series fan, but I went along for it. And I was able to watch it 3 times this week, and I was still entertained at the 3rd time. But in no way is it good filmmaking.
Yeah, I watched it twice, and I revisited all of these special features, like the rock monster that got taken out. And yeah, you summed it up great. So for me, it's like watching Shatner direct this movie is like watching my 4-year-old daughter draw a family portrait that I'm going to put on the fridge. Like, it's shit, but I love it because she did it. And it's adorable that she did it, right? 100%. So now the critical brain for me is like, I think the reason why this movie gets a bad rap for a lot of people is the subject of the movie is so deep and it's a vast and grand idea, but the execution is, I'm not going to say that it's bad in the sake of being bad. You got to remember that Shatner was a guy that would like cut other cast members' lines and give them to himself so he could get more attention, get more of the hero moments in movies, which is one of the reasons why there's such a big rift between him and Takei and a bunch of the other cast members to this very day. Think about that. Nimoy literally directed 2 of the best Star Trek movies in some people's opinions, but they're vastly different energies. Search for Spock is a very serious movie with a lot of serious themes. And then, like John said, Voyage Home is a goof. It's silly. it's more comedy. It shows like what Nimoy was doing in the 80s, directing Three Men and a Baby and other comedies like that. It showed that he could do those things. He had range. How much did that piss off Shatner, where he's like, you know what? I've got this script about finding God in the center of the universe, but we're going to make a comedy out of it too. You know, he's like, we got to do both. And that's what makes it lovable to me. It's like he really throws everything into this movie and still tries to make room for himself that it is the Shatner show. But I'm ready for the ticket. So before I pass it on to you guys for like your final take on the movie, before we go to our Siskel and Ebert review, where does it sit on my list? Like I said, it's number 4. John's not wrong. Voyage Home is my number 6. It's the bottom of my list. Then Motion Picture. Then this. Then Search for Spock. Then Wrath of Khan. And Undiscovered Country is my favorite. So again, I like all the movies. That's just my personal ranking. And I am willing to say that the fun, entertaining idea of watching, like he said, Shatner fail to success, in a sense, is what really puts this movie in the middle of my list. So where does it sit for you, Madsen?
Okay. As far as ranking goes, I said it was my third favorite. I'm basic, right? I mean, Wrath of Khan is not one of my favorite Star Trek movies. It's one of my favorite movies. It's just, you know, top 20 for me, Wrath of Khan. That's how I am. And you're right about Star Trek VI. It's your number one, my number two. What? It's super great. I mean, Christopher Plummer, Shakespeare, and everything. This one is number 3 because it's probably the Star Trek movie I've seen the most somehow for some reason.
Interesting.
Because it's one of those, I think I remember things about this. It's strangely rewatchable in a way. Like, it's not like Star Trek. It's Star Trek 3 is better, mm-hmm. right? But I don't remember anything about Star Trek 3. Like, if you ask me, it's like Christopher Lloyd is a Klingon, and Spock grows up really fast, and you kind of don't remember that one.
We got a Savick upgrade, in my opinion.
An upgrade, really? Oh, okay. Okay.
Personal opinion.
Big Robin Curtis fan.
Yes, I am. See.
That's great. That's great. No, Savick is great. Okay, but and then the rest goes, you know, I like 4, then 3, and then, you know, probably the bottom is Motion Picture, because I kind of feel like it's weirdly like going to church. And I can't really make fun of it like I can make fun of Star Trek V, which is why I like Star Trek V. I will say there are some elements that I legit do like that may be laughable. The first one is I do like that the Klingons kill God in the end, because this was an element in the series that's kind of a fun little Klingon thing. According to Klingon history, at one point, Klingons had gods and they had religion, but the Klingons actually killed their own gods because they got in their way, which is kind of that's the most Klingon thing you've ever heard, right?
Right.
So it's kind of fitting that the Klingons kill God in this. And I do like, and I think about this often, I do like the I need my pain speech.
It's one of my favorite speeches in any Star Trek movie.
Is it really?
I
was worried about it.
I love that delivery. I love that whole scene. I think that whole scene is great. It's in a different movie, and that's why I like it.
It is in a different movie. It is suddenly in a very serious Star Trek. It's the most serious element of the movie. It's far more serious than any of the God concepts that come along later. And I think ultimately the movie is destined to fail, because Star Trek is no stranger to religion and undercutting religion, questioning God, questioning the nature of, you know, deity and all that. There are 100 episodes about that, at least 100 episodes about that very same thing. Interestingly, just point of, you know, just a reference, you know, with my Star Trek podcast, I mentioned we had like listeners, we had a lot of listeners that wrote to us, and that's doing a Star Trek podcast is what made me realize the different factions among Star Trek fans, mm-hmm. because you have these stone cold atheists, humanists who live for the socialist ideal that Star Trek represents. It's like where we can go, where we can come together as society. and, you know, we don't need religion getting in the way. There's that hardcore. But also, especially like next gen in the 80s and the like cleanliness of the show, the content cleanliness of the show, it attracted a lot of deeply religious people. Mm-hmm. And I experienced like both sides of that fandom. And with as far as the way this movie tackles God, Justin, you said it earlier, both of those fandoms left completely unsatisfied. The people who believe in God said, okay, well, this is just, it's just, it's like found one random creature in the galaxy who says he's God. And so kind of, so the point is that there's no God. That doesn't make any sense. And then, you know, all the people who were like, well, I don't believe in God, you know, why would I watch a movie that kind of portrays a God in this sense? And it doesn't go harsh enough in that direction. And so, yeah, the movie, I don't care who you are or what you believe in God, Star Trek V does not espouse your view.
So, Justin, your final recap and then some of the things that you actually kind of enjoy this movie, because I didn't do mine yet, and I'll do mine at the end before we get into the critique, because there's going to be some discourse on the critique for sure. But go ahead with that.
Well, I'm sure I'm going to piss off a lot of Star Trek fans, and I'm so glad John brought the motion picture to the table, because that is going to be my bottom two. And between this one and the motion picture, to me, I love the fact that we have flaws. I love the roller coaster effect, because our characters are going to have flaws. And if we look at this series holistically, it's a fun journey. It's a fun ride. But when it comes to when Star Trek tries to do heavy topics or heavy filmmaking, that's where it falters and we lose track of the fun. And this one lost me, and I solidified my decision on this one when we get into the climax, the final act, and we get the up-close shot, which is, I think, Shatner's only good shot in this movie, of the plaque to boldly go where no one has gone before. That is a setup to something greater. That is a promise that we are going to get something of substance, and it never gets there. When we have sci-fi mixed religion, you have to be committed to really have a compare and contrast and have a thought come out of that theater or come out of the credits, and we don't. So that's where we take the motion picture and this one, and I almost put them together because they are two of the most ambitious movies of the series, but they just don't get there. One is extremely slow, and your mind just starts to slow down because of the heavy filmmaking. This one tackles heavy topics and just doesn't have good filmmaking. So to me, I think these are my bottom two, but again, it's a holistic journey of Star Trek, and I love the journey.
You know, the thing that I want to mention really fast, tackling onto your thing about the ending and the finale, I think one of the problems with this film is that its villain is not a satisfying villain. And I'm all for empathetic villains. I'm all about villains that have, let's say, a higher purpose. Because this guy, I mean, he doesn't even really want to kill anybody, right? He doesn't kill anybody for the most part. He just tricks everyone to get onto this ship and then get to the center of the universe through the Great Barrier to Shakari. And he's got all of this knowledge and all of these smarts, yet Kirk is the one that asks, why does God need a spaceship? Why does God need a starship? As that's like the breaking moment of the argument that crumbles this false deity's quest and mission. It makes me feel unsatisfied because the way they've built up Cybok as the villain and Spock's half-brother about the movie, it's like he's all-knowing and knowledgeable. Yet in that third act, he's a dumbass. And that pissed me off because he should have been the most critical of this. And I get it. It speaks to blind faith, but at the same time, you would think that he would have asked that question first. But of course, that goes to the Kirk moment. So again, it's like, I don't feel like the character's performance, Lawrence Luckbill as Cybok, I don't feel it's bad. I feel it's like a poorly drawn character and a poorly drawn villain. Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and say the few things that I really like about this movie before we jump into the critique and the discourse. I love the fact that we have the crazy bar scene out in the middle of nowhere, Paradise City, named after a Guns N' Roses song, apparently. We got the cat lady who apparently is severely allergic to water because she dies the second he throws her in that little fish tub or whatever that thing is. I love that whole thing. I love the fact that we have this band of essentially they're humans, but they may as well be Ewoks. They're primitive. They join the fight. They win, take over Paradise City. I love that fact. But my favorite part is they bring in such a wonderful character actor as David Warner to play like the Terran ambassador for this city. And he's so wasted in this movie that they're like, you know what? We got to make him the badass Klingon in the next one. So we get two David Warners back to back because they didn't use him enough in this one. That's probably like my favorite thing about this movie.
It's like a weird, like, what's his name? Mitchell, Joe Don Baker move, like in the James Bond
right,
movies.
Right.
We just like make him one character in one movie and then follow him with the very next movie. Yeah.
Right. Because we like him so much, but we didn't use him enough. All right. Okay, so we're ready to hear what these guys have to say about this movie.
All righty.
Let's do it.
Our first movie is the fifth in the Star Trek series, and I'm afraid I'm going to have to say that it's the worst. Star Trek V is so slow to get moving and so confused in its plotting that it's going to be of interest, I think, mainly to Trekkies, and then only so they can analyze what's wrong with it. The movie begins with the crew of the Starship Enterprise being called back to the ship on an emergency basis, which means, of course, we find them in the midst of their shore leave on Earth. And here are Kirk, Spock, and Bones on vacation in the single silliest scene in all of Star Trek history. The Starship's mission, rescue three hostages who have been taken by a Vulcan named Cybok, whose hidden strategy is to capture the Enterprise. Star Trek V is one of the most oddly constructed movies I've seen in a while, with its almost endless introductory scenes where they laboriously gather all of these people from all of their vacations and tell them they have to go on this mission. Then it leads up to a plot so confused that some of the characters are introduced and then hardly ever seen again, just in the background at a cocktail party. After the Enterprise gets through the Great Barrier and into the Galactic Center, the story goes completely haywire, and I can think of at least five logical questions about what happens there that I doubt if anyone could answer on the basis of anything in this movie. I was also dismayed by the movie's closing scene showing the Enterprise crew and the dreaded Klingons as guests at the same party. I'll forgive them the lousy special effects, but turning the Klingons into nice guys holding a drink and making small talk is going too far.
Okay, he's not wrong about that last part. The fact that we can jump from Star Trek V to Star Trek VI, where Kirk literally says, "Let them die," is kind of a suspension of disbelief, but I can give it a pass. Madsen, what...
I'm honestly a little bit surprised that Roger Ebert is just, he has his, you know, I guess if you're going to be a racist, you may as well be racist for a fictional race of people. I suppose it makes more sense if you're watching Next Gen at this time that they soften the Klingons in Next Gen. Mm-hmm. And so it makes less sense if you're just following the movies. And we're just judging the movies, though. So, yeah, that is the movie's fault. That is the movie's fault.
Well, it's no surprise that Roger hated this one, because we've talked about this before with Roger, is when you mix heavy topics like religion, something thought-provoking, and you don't address it in a sci-fi movie, Roger is going to hate it. Roger loves his sci-fi movies to come out of with a thought or an intent to prove a thesis or whatever it may be. Here, we don't get that. It's everything we've talked about so far. And when we're watching a sci-fi, or Roger's watching a sci-fi film, even if it's Star Trek, he can appreciate the cheesiness of it. But if you dangle that carrot of a thought, that's where he's going to go all in. If you dangle that carrot within the first 30 minutes, he's going to go all in of what this movie's intent is supposed to be. And he's going to be asking those questions. So he's not wrong here. We probably have those same questions that we've kind of dangled in this conversation. So to me, Roger's not wrong. I think he's pretty spot on here.
Well, I just think it's interesting the fact that, you know, as a critic, they watch this movie once, they're comparing it to whatever Star Trek films they reviewed before it, and they're giving their like initial opinion of, is it worth your money or not? And we talked about this a lot of times in the show. So much of my love for the movies that we talk about that they don't like, I found love through rewatches. I found love through replays. They don't have that advantage. So on surface, yes, this movie can be very challenging for a critic, because if he says he loves it and then you see the movie in the theater, you're like, what are these special effects? What is this wannabe Sean Connery guy that we have here? what is this weird kind of inconsistency in the editing? We talked about it offline. There's literally a scene where Cybok has like this long kind of matted hair throughout the entire movie. And then in the shuttle ride down from the Enterprise to Shakari, he exits and he's got a nice trim haircut with no sign of matted hair. Did we miss something? Is it just bad editing? Is it bad script consistency? Yes, it's all of those things.
Sounds like a miracle to me.
Yeah, I mean, they're looking for a miracle. They found it. There's a great clips on the whatever that thing is, the Copernicus, I think it's called. So I get it. This is a nightmare of a film for a critic, and that is where I come in. I'm usually like the conscientious objector of the pod, where Justin's the actual critic, and he often sides with that. To kind of cap off what I'm saying with Roger, is Roger so forgiving of nonsense? And that's what makes his defense of movies that I love that are nonsensical so important. But just like Justin said, if there is a thought of theology or logic or mysticism that doesn't follow through the entire movie with its tone, he shits on it. And that's what he's doing here.
You know, interestingly, you mentioned, you know, the villain doesn't the villain doesn't quite have like the I can't remember exactly what you said, but the problem you have with the villain of the movie, and I was kind of waiting with like, oh, Antonio, are you going to say Cybok the villain? Or are you going to say God the villain? Because you could have had your pick as far as picking the villain. And that's probably another issue with these big ideas. The real villain probably, I would say God is the villain of this movie. And a big key that was missing is the communication or the interaction that the main villain has with the henchman. Mm-hmm. In this case, Cybok, right? We don't really see how Cybok was deceived or manipulated by this being when Cybok is going around deceiving and manipulating other people when he's so good at that. And at one point, you know, he attempts to do the I feel your pain to God himself, right? But as a concept, I like Cybok as a villain. If you're going to have, if you're going to tackle religion and have deity kind of be the negative energy of this movie, I really like that the deity's messenger is just Space Jesus.
Right.
And this villain is just walking through the desert. He's in a robe. He's got a beard. He is being nice to people and he's healing them. And, you know, at one point, he actually gives the Enterprise back to Captain Kirk. He's like, no questions asked. You want to meet God just as much as... Oh, sorry, my cat just pushed my mic away.
I know, I watched it. It's awesome.
you want to meet God just like I do. And, you know, he's just like this Space Jesus turns the other... I like the concept of Jesus as a villain. We're going to tackle religion, so we're going to have this guy dressed as Jesus be the antagonist of the movie.
I never even looked at it that way, where he is Space Jesus. But yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And it's funny, too, because, yeah, who is the real villain? It's almost like in Tron. I think Tron has got a very... David Warner, again. Like, is MCP the villain? Or is it his character in the real world? Is his character in the game grid? It's like a trifecta of villains, but who is the main one? It's the MCP. But yeah, it's very similar to that. I never thought of Cybok as Space Jesus, and that makes so much more sense now that, yeah. And my opinion is on this, because I've tried to deconstruct the logic behind this. I think the reason why Cybok is the messenger is because being a Vulcan, full-blooded, not half-human like Spock is, being a Vulcan who gave up all of his... devotion to the Vulcan way of having your emotions suppressed and things like that, but still maintaining that logic. Now you've got the highest level of logic with the highest level of susceptibility to influence than a Vulcan would. So I think that's what they were going for in the subtext, but the execution isn't there.
Yeah. It's again, execution. Yeah. For so many things, like so many fun things. It could have been. It's fun now, but it could have been maybe less fun, but more interesting.
Well, and I think this is where it could have been even more relevant today versus the time, is we don't even have to go the full Jesus or God aspect of it, but just proving the point of the danger of who we follow, the belief, the religion, because there is a lot of benefits to religion, but there's also a danger. There are dangers in religion of how we view or how we follow, where we push off the ones we love in a negative way at some aspects of it. When you get so obsessed with one thing and a faceless hope, if I may say that, there is, and we see those points here where we see even crew members pull a little bit away from Shatner. And that's where I think is an overlaying topic here of who we follow and what are the dangers and where is the outcome. I think if this movie, if I were to play the woulda, coulda, shoulda game here, if we just kept it as simple as that without an overlaying added villain that means nothing at this point in this movie and just have an empathetic villain, there's no problem with that. The situation, the stakes is the pure villain. We don't need an added element to that. We just need the theme to be a villain. And I think that's what really could have made this movie more solidified is just have a villain that we don't hate, we don't like. We just hate the situation that he's pushing onto the other characters. I think that was the missing secret sauce here.
Right. No, that's really good. That would have, like you said, that would have upped the stakes. And I think one of the most hilarious things about Star Trek V, and kind of a reason I like it, is because the stakes just kind of get sucked away completely.
They do.
It's like the biggest stakes in the universe. We're meeting God. Like, what could be bigger stakes than that? But then it turns out, no, we're just meeting some jerk. That's it. That, those are the whole stakes.
Who got stuck on a planet. Who got ditched by his friends millennia ago in the center of the universe. I mean, okay, so my retort to that is I think that this movie kind of is a litmus test for where you are with your own personal spirituality, because I am more pissed off at the Enterprise crew who fall susceptible to Cybok's pain relief and his ways of manipulation than I do when Chekhov gets the ear slug that changes his brain and essentially makes him a traitor. I'm more pissed off at the guys that follow Space Jesus than I am at the brain beetle that Chekhov gets. So that's where I think it shows where my spirituality is like, oh, dude, like I trust the beetle more than I trust this guy with his pain relief. Anyway, let's hear what Gene has to say about this.
I don't know where to begin, but let me try with, first of all, the presence of a tremendous amount of liquor in this movie. I was astonished to find that basically these guys are more than social drinkers. I'm talking about the Klingons. I'm talking about the crew and the Starship Enterprise.
The Vulcans.
Everyone's getting sloshed in this film. Maybe they've read the script. It is astonishing to hear these people sing Row, Row, Row Your Boat. And believe it or not, that's the payoff scene at the end of the picture, that they can sing Row, Row Your Boat. I mean, it's not emotional. It's laughable. I think the time has passed for any new developments in the hardware area. Mm-hmm. They rip off the sequence from Star Wars of the bar with all the grotesque animals. Uh-huh. I mean, there's no energy in this picture whatsoever.
The movie it looks to me as if they started shooting at just about the point they should have started rewriting the script, because it's really out of whack. I mean, the first hour is just deadly dull. Nothing happens. Right. And then when they get involved with the plot, I couldn't understand it.
No, it's
they bring
beyond
in
me.
David Warner, an excellent actor.
Yeah.
He comes in, he's introduced, he's a character, he has lots of lines, then what happens to him? Well, I don't know.
There's some heavy editing that had to be
done.
There
are three or four characters like that in this movie who are introduced and then have nothing to do.
There are three or four storylines that are started out and, you know.
And the key,
lousy.
The key, well, anyway, forget about the key questions about what's beyond the Great Barrier, because the key question is, why was it there to begin with?
Justin and I have a little game we play when these two go so off topic that they don't actually spend time doing real critiques on the film. Instead, they just kind of pick one thing and go with it. And this is one of those things where they really just kind of pick the same horse and they kick the shit out of it. And we don't really get any critique on the actual filmmaking, the camera, the lighting. I personally think this is one of the best looking Star Trek films cinematically. Like, it's beautiful. I think it was Andrew Laszlo that was the director of photography. Fantastic job. Special effect sequences, that's a different story, but just the general framing of the film I think is gorgeous. The music, of course, you can't beat that score, you know, bringing back the motion picture score, which was used in Next Generation. So yeah, this got a lot of winning moments for it. But when it comes to their critique, it's the thing, I hate it when they do this. When they both don't like a film, instead of really focusing on the things that they could tell us about the film, they pick one lane and they just ride it all the way home for 4 minutes. That's where I feel about the critique.
Well,
thanks. I was just going to say, I do appreciate Siskel's critique because it's still something I never noticed before, how sloshed everybody was getting. I leave it up to him to point that out. And that's just another funny thing. And they were laughing about it. I commend that critique for helping me enjoy the movie just a little bit more, because it's just a silly thing. Yeah, just a silly thing.
I had a guest on a couple weeks ago who commented on the Cop and a Half episode that Justin and I did. And he was saying his least favorite thing about Gene is that he was so forgiving of like sex comedies and erotic thrillers, but he was such a spinstery prude when it came to alcohol, drug abuse, and violence and children in danger. And it was just kind of a weird thing to be contradictory about. It's like, okay, you know, hey, this French sex comedy where the dude's like sleeping with an underage girl, it was charming, but how dare we put a kid in danger? What kind of garbage is this? And of course, the first thing he goes to is like, how can you effectively fly the Enterprise when you're constantly drinking?
Well, I think John said it. It's the term of leave it to Gene. And I think that should leave be trademarked in this show. Leave it to Gene.
That's the t-shirt.
We have Roger that's looking for thought. We have Gene that's looking at the small details just to keep himself entertained, because he's not a Trekkie. Ebert was. So he's looking for something in a Star Trek film to really just hold on to. And he has his little notepad out just making dash marks of how many times people drink in a Star Trek movie. I didn't see it the first 3 times, and I still don't care. I don't care. Let him get sloshed on the Enterprise. I would love to see that. And even if I were to contradict Roger, I loved the first act. I loved the first 30 minutes. I thought it was a good starting point. I loved the malfunctioning Enterprise. I love that nothing works. If I had a critique on it, I say throw Scotty in a little bit more, because I loved his like chaotic entrances into the chaotic Enterprise. So I like the first one. I think it was a good setup. Does it match the rest of the tone of the movie? No, but it still entertained me. So I think between the two of them, I think Gene gives no substance to this movie, no real critical review. This is him picking the one paragraph to put him over the character line of his newspaper review just to meet his quota at this point. And he thought it was funny, so he's putting it on video. But there's nothing else in a critique here to really tell an audience what was really there not to buy a ticket, or what was there to buy a ticket. So this one, I think, was completely off for Gene. And I love Roger use that as an opportunity to throw a couple of those questions he didn't get in his introduction to his critique.
I got to say really fast, like you hit a point that I wanted to bring up earlier and I totally forgot, is that Scotty is like the, let's say, behind the scenes MVP of this movie. And it made me think about how difficult it is to write like a cinematic narrative for this cast, that in a series, they all of them had turns of like, oh, this is Scotty's episode. This is Sulu's episode. This is Chekhov's episode. Like in The Simpsons, like this is Lisa's episode, which means I can turn it off now, you know, but the thing about this one is Scotty, and they give Scotty and this moment where I feel like it might have been written in the script and left on the floor, but I feel like there was like a burgeoning romance between Scotty and Uhura. Like they have like this bond in this one that they don't have in the other ones, and I love that. I wanted more of that. And they essentially waste Scotty in part 6, which I think is very unfortunate. But if he did get his chance to shine in a movie, it was in this movie. I think that he was like literally the best laughs come from Scotty, even like the dumb, I'm going to hit my head and pass out for half the movie. I still dug it. I think he's the MVP of this movie, even though he's not a major character in it.
100%.
I'm a fan. I'm a fan of Scotty. I like them all. Who am I kidding? I'm a Star Trek guy.
Okay, so now is a point in the show where we critique our critics. We've got Gene, we got Roger. I always critique Gene, and Justin always critiques Roger. And I think that since our special guest here is very opinionated on both what these guys have to say, I'm going to let him critique both. Now, I do the letter score. Justin does the star score. So I'm going to go ahead and start with my review for Gene. You know what? Like I said before, I cannot bash a critic for not liking a movie just because I like it. yeah, there are a lot of flaws in this movie, but that's not what I'm judging him on. I'm judging him on how is he really critiquing the film for us, or is he just talking mad shit because he didn't like it, which is leaning more towards that. So because of his lack of detail and his focus on the drinking habits of the Federation, I'm going to give him a D on this review.
I think that's fair. And you know what? Roger, I'm going to give a little bit of credit here because he does utilize a little bit of Gene's time to throw in a couple points. I can't disagree with anything that he says, but, you know, based on his written review and the televised review, I would have loved to see what went right to give people that are fans of this series some hope of what they're about to see. So this one, I can't disagree, but at the same time, it's a near miss. I'm almost in between. I'm going to give him 2.5 on it because I think there are elements here, like we've all discussed, is there are some things to take away of likability, whether that's for me, the first 30 minutes of it, the first act, or for some, the holistic movie of it. So in some people that are hardcore Shatner fans are going to like his direction. They're fools, but they'll like their direction. So, but it's going to be a near miss for me at 2.5.
All right. I'm going to grade them with my patented grading scale of Federation insignias 1 to 47. We're going to go a 19 out of 47 for the combined both. I mean, Ebert, I agree. Justin, I really like the first hour of this movie. I think it's stronger than the second hour. I don't think it's a slog. It's getting the gang back together. Mm-hmm. It's having a lot of fun. And I just simply don't think the critique makes sense in my mind. And Siskel, again, he's in his critique. He's saying this is a bad part of the movie. I think it's a good part of the movie. I think it's hilarious that they saved all their drinking for this one movie. And you know, that's totally fine with me, but what it comes down to it is I know these guys. I know, you know, Roger Ebert, I believe is Catholic, and Siskel, I believe you guys know more about these guys than I do, but I believe Siskel is Jewish. I don't think he's like a religious Jew, but he, you know, has the philosophies down. They could have had a really great, rousing conversation about the implications that the movie tries to bring up. They could have executed. Yeah.
Right, the theology.
But they
of
didn't.
It.
They steered mm-hmm. completely away from that. And, you know, and I guess I can blame the movie for that because the movie just fails in its execution. But they could have stepped up in tackling the lack of execution with their own execution of the topic. But they just talked about meaningless things. So.
I give it 5 out of 5 Shatners. that's kind of where I'm at with this one. So, John, thank you so much for joining us. How about you tell us what's coming up on yours, mine, and theirs, which I didn't really give you a chance to explain. People have heard you on my other show, but let's tell our new listeners what the concept of yours, mine, and theirs is.
Well, yours, mine, and theirs is pretty much like a mini Oscar party where there's a field of 3 movies that we talk about throughout the podcast, and they all have a different, you know, genre associated with them. For example, let's just say trial movies, and it's movies that our guests pick and Facebook community picks, and so they come together for our trial movies. This last time we did Legally Blonde, A Few Good Men, and 12 Angry Men, and I just published that a few minutes ago, and so hey. That's pretty fun. It's always like those 3 things or 3 movies a guest brings. But Antonio, I know you say this. The funnest part is since we have 3 movies, we give the awards to all the movies at the very end. We have, 25 different awards, and they're each of these movies is duking out for the best alien, the best recurring character, the best laugh out loud moment. And so that's what we do on our podcast. It's a little hard to get into because sometimes you have to watch 3 movies before you listen to it. But hey, you know what? Don't watch the movies. Just listen. That'd be great.
Best death is still my favorite category.
I love that one. Yeah.
That, especially in those movies where there's no death, you have to come up with like a hypothetical death.
Yes.
You know,
or a hypothetical titular line where the name of the movie is said when the name of the movie is never said. And so you make one up.
I think I expressed it on your guys' Facebook page that I'm disappointed about these three films in this category because you call it legal dramas. So for one, Legally Blonde is a comedy.
Yeah, it's not that funny though.
Okay, yeah, I guess the tears that you cry during the film, during the movie, make you consider it a drama. But anyway, oh yeah, so make sure that you go and listen to, subscribe to Yours, Mine, and Theirs. Do it on Spotify. That's where they like to track all of their listens on, is on Spotify. You'll find the link to that in the notes of this episode. Now, the last little bit of business we have, what are we doing next week? So, we brought, some would say, an inferior sequel to the show this week, and who are we to break tradition? Justin is bringing RoboCop 2 Ooh. To the show. What do people think about RoboCop 2? What do Siskel and Ebert know about RoboCop 2? I'll tell you what I think about it next week on the show. Justin, what do you think? Why did you bring this movie?
I think this one, and I'll just give my opinion up front, is underrated, and I think critics didn't give it a fair chance and just get sucked into the sequel fun of it. So I think this one was a miss on critics because it was years of overdone sequels, and it had an unfair shot.
Right, and it's not like we're living in an era of overdone sequels at this moment in time, so... What do we know about sequels, right?
Nothing.
I really have not listened to their critique of this film yet. I'm going to save that for the recording, but I'm excited because, like I say, if a movie's on my shelf, it means I probably like it. And I've got all three RoboCops sitting on my shelf right now, but not the remake with Jackie Earl Haley and Gary Oldman. I don't have that. All right, everyone, you know what to do. Like, subscribe, give us 5 stars, review us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, jump on our YouTube, subscribe there. And if there are any films that you want us to cover, as long as Siskel and Ebert covered it on their show and there is a video episode available, don't try and tomfoolery us and give us a movie that does not exist on YouTube that we can't find the review for. It's happened twice now. We'll do it. We want that listener input. We want that listener feedback, and we want to hear what you want us to cover. And with that, Justin Henson, I'll see you next week. John Madsen, thank you for joining us. Have a good night.
See you next week.